you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ross Sutton, the SDR show. This week, a really cool dude. He is from a band called Blur, but so much more than that, and putting out a solo album. His name is David Roundtree. Had a really fun interview with him, and I was really impressed by this dude. You'll hear me kind of gush about it at the beginning of the episode. We do this every Wednesday, every Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern time, and you could watch or listen for free on YouTube or anywhere you're consuming it. It has ads. It comes out 5 days later. Or go to gasdigitalnetwork.com, use the code SDR, get a 7-day free trial, get 20% off, access to every episode we've ever done, and 21 other shows, all of them in HD, commercial-free, at gasdigitalnetwork.com. And that fun feeling to know that you're supporting the show and supporting the network. But really, just get the word out there. That's all that really matters. Spread the love, listen to the show, and let's do it right now. It's the David Roundtree episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone fuck the hoe. It's beat, I beat. It's hookers and blow. It's art, it's far. You need to know. The SDR Show. Let's go.
It is the SDR Show, sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. I am Ralph Sutton. Back with me very often, it is James Madden. How are you, buddy?
Yo, man. What up, baby?
So I'll tell you this. First of all, James, you still need to get about, I'm going to say, 8-inch wider drapes. That's what you need. About 8-inch wider.
Fun this way. It's a crack in the window is a blank in the sky. Whatever that Aussie lyric was. I screwed it up. I shouldn't
and
have
I went. Still have, I'm in the midst of redecorating my apartment. So it's getting there. So it looks
you got a
weird.
Fucking fax machine in the back. You're like, you need drapes. You got a 1988 device behind you, Bubba.
That is actually a giant color laser printer. And when the all network right. was in my house, I used to need it all the time, but we don't need it anymore. So just sitting here. Anyway, let's get it. I'm going to tell you the story. So I'm about to introduce our guest, and here's what happens. David, I'm the guy that does the research, that looks shit up, that tries to figure out who is the person we're about to interview more than just what you know superficially, right? And usually my co-host, like James is a comic. He can rely on being funny because he's funny, and I have to do the research, right?
Yeah.
So very often when I research someone, their name is not just them. Like, there's other people that have that name. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's somebody else. I got to look into it. So I know you first and foremost, Dave Roundtree, the drummer of Blur, got a new solo album out called Radio Songs. Fine. So we start looking into it. And then I see, oh, there's a politician named David Roundtree. Oh, there's a composer. Oh, there's an animator named David Roundtree. All these people, a pilot named David Roundtree. And then I find out, oh, no. They're all the same fucking person. They're all you. And I found that to be fucking fascinating that are all these different aspects of your life that sum up David Roundtree. So David Roundtree, of all these things, musician, politician, pilot, composer, animator, welcome to the show.
Thank you. The one you missed was there's a regional football team in the south of England, and their star player was also called Dave Roundtree, and that's the one that isn't me. Also,
oh, okay, he didn't show up, so that's good.
In Australia, I have a Google, because I'm kind of sad like that, I have a Google alert set up for Dave Roundtree, and it turns out there's an Australian villain called Dave Roundtree who went on a spree of villainy a few years ago. He stole a shotgun from another member of his family and went around holding up
wow.
stations. So he's the exciting branch of the Dave Roundtree family. comparison.
Do you know if there's any actual direct relation between you and those guys, or it's just that you?
I think there, but for the grace of God, go I. You know, it's probably, from the transported to Australia section of my family some years ago.
It's very possible, but it is wild. I mean, I often say, because like I deal with a lot of comedians in the network that I own and the people that I associate with. And it's, for me, most of them, and this is not a dig at you, James, but most of them, they just want to talk comedy. I was at this venue, this audience, this joke, this person's doing it. Like 90% of the comedians' conversations is either comedy or maybe sports and video games. That's about it, right? But I often say, if your life is summed up by one or two interests, you're a fucking boring person. And you definitely take that 100% in the other direction.
I didn't know Ralph was Michelangelo. I didn't realize when I do this show that I got such a renaissance, man. I'm going to, should I start reading Tolstoy before I do this? I'm sorry.
Please do, James.
That I need make to me carry feel- my weight, gentlemen. God damn.
So let's just start with the one that, to get it out of the way, we'll get into the new album and all the other stuff. But the first one that's just the hot topic of the moment, because I don't know when it was announced, not that long ago, that after I don't know how many years, maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe more, Blur is doing a reunion show at Wembley Stadium in 2023. That's pretty fucking wild.
That is wild. It was suggested some years ago, and then for one reason or another, just never seemed to happen. And even before Christmas, it didn't look like it was going to happen. I was ringing up the other band members saying, look, I just don't think we should set the store on this. It doesn't seem likely. And then all of a sudden, bing, something changed. Everything was on, you know, suddenly a date became free as a date that we could all make. And it was like, you know, went from, oh, well, don't get too excited, it's probably not going to happen, to, it's happening, and we need to put the tickets on sale on Friday.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. And it's the first time you guys are doing Wembley, I think.
Yeah, it is. And it's just so crazy. And it's like, so it's the UK equivalent of the Madison Square Garden or, you know, the Hollywood Bowl or something like that. It's the iconic venue that all the bands whose records I bought when I was a kid would end up playing at, you know,
right.
Kind of, it just never seemed very likely that we would end up there. And we did two nights. It was bizarre. The first night sold out in about 30 seconds flat. And then magically, almost as if there was a God, the show that was on the night after us canceled. So there was a free date the night after it. So they said, do you want to do that one as well? I mean, what can you say when asked, do you want to do a second night at Wembley Stadium? How many answers are possible to that question?
I mean, just, you know, I would guess if the first one didn't sell out in 30 seconds, the answer would be maybe not. Yeah. But if it sold out in 30 seconds, you say yes, right?
You say, fuck yeah. I mean, that's the only possible answer to that question.
So just a couple of other Blur questions, and then we'll go on to the other aspects of your life. Because I was a fan from when I first heard There's No Other Way way back in fucking 91. The one question is, I do my research, I didn't see the answer to this anywhere. Where did the name Blur come from?
We had a different name every gig up until the point where we signed by the record company, and they said, this has to stop. You come up with a list of names. We at the record label will come up with a list of names, and then we'll sit down over dinner and we will compare lists. And bizarrely, Blur was on both lists. It's
really
not as unlikely as it sounds, because at that time, the fashion was for very short names, you know, Lush, mm-hmm. Ride, these Pulp, these were, you know, a one syllable name was very fashionable at that point. So pretty much all of the names that we both came up with were one syllable ones. But yeah, Blur was on both. We took that as an omen. And also it's a sort of blank canvas name. What does it mean? Not entirely sure.
I thought it was as homage to all the drugs you guys did that your history was a bit of a blur.
that all came later.
Fair enough. And I like that. I mean, the last album was in 2015, and you said in an interview you believe the best Blur album is yet to come. Blur has been great in the fact that a lot of their albums, which also was true with your new solo record, they don't sound a lot like the album before it, you know, which I think is very indicative of Blur. And you on the new Radio Songs record, a lot of the songs don't sound like they're part of the same album. Like they're kind of like different aspects of your life. Was that intentional, or was just whatever interested you at the time? And where is that going to take you for whatever album is going to come next through Blur?
Well, I think that's what I've taken away from all my time writing music with Blur and making records with Blur, really, is that you have to give to each song what the song demands. And if that means the album ends up sounding quite eclectic and difficult to categorize, well, so much the better, you know. Right. The song has to lead the way when you're converting it into a record, really. And so, you know, there's not much Blur-like, I think, about my record, but it's hard to say what's Blur-like, really. But the one thing that is Blur-like is my approach to making records out of songs.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you're going to work on a new album, I guess, with Blur? That's the plan, or you don't know yet?
Well, that's the next discussion to be had. We've just put the tour to bed. We just all managed to agree on whose diaries are free on which day and all of this kind of stuff. So you can imagine what that's like. But anyway, that's done and dusted. So yeah, the next conversation, and a conversation which really we should have had last year, or if not the year before, because we've left it rather late, is what, if anything, are we going to record? We usually do something, though. If we want to do a whole album, we'd better get cracking. We need to be starting now, really.
Right, because also there was a hell of a time between Think Tank and Magic Whip, but like over 10 years, so you don't want to make another 10 years between these two. All right, last couple of Blur questions, then we're going into the solo stuff. Is it true that, I mean, the biggest song, obviously, that you probably guys could retire on is Song 2. In every fucking sporting event, in every movie, it's everywhere. Is it true that was written as a joke, almost like a fuck you, here's your radio hit joke, and then it ended up becoming the biggest song for the band? Is that true?
No. Next.
All right. Good.
It was a song that was never really finished. You know, we were in the recording sessions and we had a whiteboard on the wall of all the songs we'd started, you know, song one, song two, song three, song four. And then the columns were what we'd done. When we tick it off, when you do the drums, you tick it off, when you do the vocals, backing vocals, mixed, mastered, tick off all the columns, you see. So, down we go, and as the lyrics get written, we rub out song number one and replace it with the actual title of the song. Well, song two, Damon tried writing some lyrics and re-singing it, because he just goes blah blah boo blah blah blah, blah when he sings, rather better than that, has to be said. But he makes kind of random English sounding syllables to give him the kind of guide when he's singing, when he's singing the guide track, and then he uses that as a guide to write the vocals with. So he kind of turned that into something about something, re-sang it. It just sounded awful, you know. So it's hard to sometimes recapture that spirit that you get when you're all excited, you know, the song's coming together. Quick, do your thing, you know. Damon, quickly put a guide vocal down, you know. It's hard to recapture that spirit. With that song, it turned out to be impossible. So the vocals got abandoned. It never really got a name. It remained song two on the whiteboard on the wall. Damon did, I think, re-sing a couple of words here and there to make it kind of seem like it's about something, it's in English, you know. But by and large, it's still him going, you bad daddy, you fat boo.
That's cool. That's great. And also, I guess you intentionally, at some point, when you realized you're going to keep it as song two, you made it 2 minutes, or did that just was a happy accident?
No, that's just, again, the song came together really quickly, frighteningly quickly. You know, it was one of those moments, like, you know, where, I don't know if you play tennis, but some days, one day a year, it seems like the tennis racket is 6 foot wide and 12 foot tall and you can't miss, and every shot goes, sails over the net past your opponents, you know, and you think, God, if only it'd be like that every day. Well, that was the song equivalent of that. Everybody's ideas worked straight out of the box, first time. It was very, very quick to write and record, and just kind of worked straight away. So it's 2 minutes long, because I mean, there's one idea. The idea is woohoo! And you don't have to keep doing that for. You know what I mean? 2 minutes is pushing it, if you ask me.
This is something I've always wondered, and you don't have to tell me the price, but A, do you guys get paid? I always wonder when I was just at a ball game. Do you guys get anything for them playing that at arenas?
In America, I think not, because copyright works slightly differently in America.
Oh, no.
In the UK, we would get paid. The venues have a, I mean, it's not a big amount. The venues buy a venue license, and so all the music that gets played gets reported to the collecting societies, and they sort of divvy out as the small amount that this license is worth. In America, I think maybe venues have music licenses as well, but you only get paid for certain aspects of your music in America. Mm-hmm. You get paid for a lot more in Europe. So I don't.
And it's also been in countless movies too. I'm sure you get paid for that. That's got to be.
And you get paid. I mean, even more so, it's been used to sell every brand of car known. And each time they come in, I say, I'm very happy for this, but could I have one of the cars? And each time they say, no.
Oh, that's too bad. Now, my last Blur question, then we get into the solo record and stuff. Do you look back on that longstanding feud with Oasis at this point as just silly? Or did it make sense at the time?
Well, you have to see in the context. I'm not a cultural relativist, so I hate saying this kind of thing, but you have to see it in the context of the time. At that point in the history of British guitar music, there were four weekly broadsheet music newspapers, desperate for, and countless monthly magazines, all desperate for interesting column inches, you know. And so the bands fairly quickly learned that if you spent your time slagging off all the other bands, that made good copy and would get you in the music papers. So that's what bands did in those days. You'd put your record out and say how crap everybody else's record was. That would be in your interview.
All right, fair enough. That makes sense.
Yeah, you know, when we came across Oasis, though, we came across a band who would punch back. So for every time we compared them to Status Quo, you know, they would come back calling us kind of white, southern, lily-livered, you know, blah, blah, blah. Who knows what they even said. In fact, I think they came back with rather better insults than that. That was good. I'm not denigrating that insult. That was great.
That's really funny. Did you guys ever break bread and now you're friends or you don't even know each other?
Oh, yeah, that was all over as quickly as it started, really. You know, everybody moved on. But what it did, there was good sides and bad sides, really, to the fallout from that. The good sides were... it pushed both bands up to the bottom rung of the top ladder. You know, you wouldn't know it, people forget that before that, both of us were still pretty small bands. Mm-hmm. You know, we had quite a bit of success, but in those days, quite a bit of success didn't propel you into the mainstream charts particularly, you know. Mm-hmm. that was going to happen later on, you know, the mainstream change to accommodate both of our music, but it hadn't happened at that point. And so that feud got on the front page of every newspaper, literally, was the main article, you know, on the day where we had the battle of the singles. It was the headline article on all of the major news channels, on every station across the UK. You know, they had their top premier journalists standing outside record shops interviewing people on the way out saying, what did you buy, Blur?
Oh, that's really funny. That's great.
It's insane. And for a while we thought, well, there can't be any other news on, but there was when you look back, that was quite a big news day. There were kind of actual things going on in the world beyond a couple of bands full of idiots screaming at each other, you know. So it pushed us both up to the bottom rung of the top ladder, shall we say, you know, that started our international careers off, really. On the downside, pretty much every Blur interview I've done since then, they've asked me the Oasis question.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's the same for them. Journalists still wonder if that's a sensitive subject, you know. So often they ask me as the last question, you know, the one where if I storm off, they still got an interview. and I have to reassure them, no, that was like 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine you'd still be holding a grudge today. That would be weird. All right, before we go any further, a longtime sponsor of the show, we're talking about Yo Delta, their vapes, their gummies in Delta 8, gets you super high and legally shipped to a majority of the states in the United States. So if you're over the age of 21 and you want to stock up on gummies and vapes for all your getting stoned needs, there's nowhere else to go but YoDelta.com. YoDelta.com is the official Delta 8 sponsor of the entire GAS Digital Network. And if you use the promo code GAS, that's G-A-S, you're going to get 25% off your entire order. Once again, that promo code is GAS, G-A-S, and you get 25% off your entire order. YoDelta.com, home of Delta 8 that gets you super fucking high. All right, let's get back into it. James, you look like you wanted to add something.
Well, I found that feud out in the States so refreshing because at the same time, we had a musical feud going on, but it was East Coast and West Coast rap, which did not end as well as you. Like, unfortunately, we don't have Tupac in an hour to ask him if he breaks bread with Biggie. So this, it's the, if you look back at it, it's adorable. It was an adorable feud, even though Liam said some wild shit. I'm going to say this, though. You bump into Liam in the streets, it's still cool because he seems like he just keeps shooting at everybody. Brother, nieces, goddamn anyone at the store. It just seems like he doesn't stop.
Yeah, you know, those brothers, it's tough being in a band with the same people year in, year out. Right. I just can't imagine the pressure having being in a band with your actual family. You know, you kind of become each other's family with all the kind of positives and negatives that that involves. But being their actual family as well, you know, they've been together in the first 20 years of their life and then, you know, even more together the next 20 years.
Was that band, Gene Loves Jezebel, that I used to like, and there were twins in there. And they hated each other so much they started touring separately, both as Gene Loves Jezebel, which is crazy.
Yeah, I was going to ask, has there ever been brothers in a band that didn't end up hating each other? Off the top of my head, all of it. The Oasis.
The Bee Gees. Bee Gees loved each other.
Bee Gees. God bless the Bee Gees. But the Kinks, fist fights on the stage and shit. Yeah.
The Osmonds. I mean, I go back fairly far.
I think they're just all cloned, though. If we're just going to be honest, I think that's just one Osmond back and forth with a huge difference. Jesus and Mary Chain hated each other, I think. I mean, look at that.
The Black Crows have brothers in there, too, I think. They hate each other. So now, this is a nice story. You used to build radios with your dad, right? Yeah. And I assume that, A, that's where you got your love for doing radio, because you do radio. And I assume at this point you dropped your podcast because you haven't done a new episode in over a year. But radio in general seems you have a strong passion for. And it's also why your new album is called Radio Songs, correct?
Yeah, radio has been a kind of constant in my life, really. And you're right. One of those things is, you know, I come from what we would now call a dysfunctional family, I guess, a broken home. But one of the unifying factors was my dad and I's love of electronics. My dad was in the Air Force when he was a young man, and he was a radio engineer in the Air Force, taught pilots how their radios worked as part of their piloting courses. Mm-hmm. And so when he came out, he joined the BBC, as many people did from the Air Force in those days. But he maintained this love of electronics and radio, and he and I used to build radios, whereas some dads and sons would go to football matches or, you know, go fishing or something. He and I would sit around the kitchen table building radios and designing radios, and he would show me how it all works, and then we would switch it on, plug it into an antenna in the back garden and spin the dial and see what we could tune in. And I found that tremendously exciting, and I still do that to this day. However, you can't see it, but there are radios everywhere. I've got radios.
Do you still have it? Because you had a show on the BBC for a while. Do you still have a show, a radio show that you're doing?
No, that lasted for a couple of years, but it just became, well, a couple of things happened. It was, as you know, doing this kind of thing takes up your entire life, doesn't it? Yeah. People think that you just, you know, turn up and sort of let the words flow. But letting the words flow involves spending a week researching your topic and all of that. And I was working as a criminal lawyer at the time, and I just didn't have any other time left.
Yeah, I left that off in the list, by the way, that you also are a lawyer, which is fucking hilarious. Unbelievable. But it leads me to the question, by the way, because you are so passionate about radio. I come from radio. I did it for almost 20 years. I had a rock radio show that was on almost 100 stations in America. I'm curious your thoughts on radio today. Is it just, to me, it's a sad state of what it used to be. And I'm curious, as someone with such a lifelong passion of it, your thoughts on it.
Well, I think rock and pop radio is looking for its USP again. You know, that people have got so many other ways they can consume music, and the thrill of somebody, you know, phoning up and saying, can you mention me on your station? That's kind of gone. People have access to the whole world in a way that they didn't before. And so radio is looking for its USP again. These things are all cyclical. It will find it. I don't know what it is, but it will find it, and it will have its renaissance, I think. But as it stands at the moment, the new music is struggling on radio. It really is. But in the UK, all the new music shows have gone. They were trying to cancel BBC Six, the entire station, which is devoted to new and experimental music, and they were trying to close the station down, the whole station.
Wild. I mean, I remember the joy of breaking a band and like playing it before anybody. It doesn't fucking matter anymore. But I don't know. It's a very dear to my heart topic I could talk about for hours. But what I thought was fascinating is, so you build radios with your dad and you start listening to things like Radio Moscow, which had an English channel, and you as a kid, it's your first time hearing alternative takes to politics that you were aware of, and that's what made you get into politics. Is that all accurate?
Yeah, I had a very sort of conventional politics in my family, you know, kind of centre-right politics, I suppose you would say it was, you know, and we got my dad worked for the BBC, so we got our news from the BBC and some kind of centre-right newspapers, all of which was the news is very homogenous, you know, they all had the same view on things. It never occurred to me that that wasn't simply the truth, you know, what was kind of coming out of these stations. And Radio Moscow and various other Middle Eastern stations, it used to be, as probably still is, part of their kind of soft power outreach, that they would do their news broadcasts and their kind of world service news broadcasts in English. And various other languages, you know, to try and spread their worldview around. And while Radio Moscow was laughably partisan, the takeaway from it was, I had no idea that there was I was a kid at this time, I was a young kid, but it was a light bulb moment that there's another potential interpretation for these events other than the one I'm being fed by all these kind of center-right news sources. So
that's a great takeaway, that you could see all of a sudden, oh, it's not all black and white, that different people have different outlooks at the same thing. How long were you in the political space where you worked in politics?
Oh, 4 years. I did the you get elected for a 4-year term, but then for family reasons, I had to leave the city I was a politician in, so I had to stand down. So I found a great guy to take my seat over and work to get him elected. But it's something I still do. I'm still very politically active.
Right.
For me, that has meant, you know, I'm a community activist, really. I believe in working in my neighborhood, knocking on doors in my neighborhood and seeing if there are problems and seeing if I can do anything to help. You know, that's where I come from. That's the kind of politics I do. And that's
when you convince someone to vote along the path that you wanted them to, do you go, woohoo?
Oh, boy.
It's a nice idea, but I very rarely even mention politics on the doorstep.
Hold on. Can we just hold on? We have to. He's been sitting on that sir for 30 plus minutes. This was it was corny, but it was the long game to that chess move is spectacular. He's been sitting there.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much.
That's a fall. That's why he wanted to rush through Blur. He wasn't worried that you were upset with those questioning. He wanted to get this shit. Unbelievable, Ralph. Holy smokes.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Bobby Fischer.
It's like when you watch those kind of magicians and you find out right at the end that all the way through they've been tricking you, and actually the card that you were thinking of right at the start is hidden behind this picture on the wall. The entire audience off their chairs.
Thank you, everyone.
It was that moment.
And you know,
I like this quote. You said that both your parents were classically trained musicians. You dabbled in piano a bit, but then you said, what is the most annoying instrument possible? It was bagpipes. What's the second most? It's drums. And that's how you got into drums. Is that right?
Yeah, my parents were both classical musicians, and that they made me do piano lessons. So once a week, I had to have a piano lesson, and piano was taught. This was in the 1970s. Piano was taught to children in a way designed to put them off the piano for the rest of their lives. You know, they would start with scales and arpeggios and kind of build up on technical, moving your fingers around the keyboard from there before they even thought about playing a tune. You know, it was insane, absolutely insane. So I hated the piano with a vengeance. So I thought, if I can get this rule changed from you have to have a piano lesson to you have to have a musical instrument lesson, then I pick the worst, most obnoxious musical instrument known to man, which is obviously the bagpipes. They would hate it so much that they would let me off and say, "Okay, don't worry, I could go out and play football with my friends," which is what I wanted to do. Unfortunately, a bagpipes. It turns out, far from the most obnoxious instrument known to man, it's a beautiful instrument. And I was lucky enough to live in the city, which had it was a military big military base in the center of this city, and there was a Scottish regiment based there with some of the best bagpipe players in the world, who were desperate. This little kid turned up, wanted lessons. They were like, "Great, bring it on." And but unfortunately, you need an adult's physique to play the bagpipes. It's a
Oh.
fighting, shagging instrument. It's not an instrument for young fey boys who are trying to escape their piano teacher. So I didn't do very well. So yes, I thought, well, what's the second most obnoxious instrument? Obviously, the drums. But I then got from day one, got utterly obsessed with the drums I started off having some. Let there's a music school around the corner from where I lived, where if your child had any musical interest at all, the parents could dump them for the entire weekend and get on with
Oh,
being
wow.
adults. So they did this. They dumped me at this music school, and I loved it. And there was all kinds of orchestras and bands and jazz and any kind of music that you can imagine. And my drumming teacher, after one term, my drumming teacher died of a heart attack, and they
What?
didn't. They nothing to do with me. I don't take any of the blame for that. But he. So I had the. I had some those periods to myself, where I was supposed to be having learning my instrument. Me and the other drumming students just, had the run of the music school to ourselves. So we would run around getting into trouble and making silly bands up and doing all this kind of stuff. So I had a whale of a time there. So, I was at school kind of 7 days a week, really, in term time. And so that was great. And I just so fell in love with the drums, got utterly and quite unhealthily, really, obsessed with it. So if I wasn't doing anything else, I was playing the drums, and they had to drag me off the kit to make me go to bed at night.
So let me ask you this. So you have obviously then the Blur happens. We're talking about decades for Blur doing well. At some point, you start scoring shows and movies, including there's some shows right now, like on Netflix. There's one called The One, The Capture. These are shows and movies that you score. It became a whole other career for you, besides the political, besides the lawyer, besides the drumming. Now you score movies and shows for a living. I imagine, A, it's a very different take when you're writing music for movies and scores. You got to do what they want, not what you want. But are you finding that as a real passion, or is that just something that makes you extra money on the side?
It's an interesting challenge, it's very interesting. It's a lot of work. I mean, it's almost like having a job, I would say. You kind of so it takes about 3 to 6 months to do each of these shows, and you have to write a lot of music, and most of it 2 or 3 times until you get what the director wants. So you might have to write, if a like The Capture, for example, that was six 1 hour shows. So maybe 2.5 to 3 hours of music you have to write. So that's 3 albums worth of music, and you have to write it 2 or 3 times. So it's a lot of work, but it's a very interesting challenge. I wasn't used to thinking about music in that way, because you are the viewer's emotions, the music. You're the one that tells them how to feel about what's going on. And there's some really interesting YouTube video showing the same boring scene of a car just driving.
Right. And then you show, of course, I love those things. Show you how important music is. Yeah. Did it change your approach to songwriting for your album because of this?
Not so much the approach to songwriting, because songs is a different thing. You know, you can't write songs like you write film music and vice versa. But it did mean the film scoring career did mean I've got a recording studio full of instruments that I use to compose film scores. So that's one of the reasons why that my solo album sounds like it does. It sounds quite filmic. Mm-hmm. And actually, the last track on the album called Who's Asking was originally a piece of film music. I wrote a choral piece for a pitch I was working on for a film I was trying to do, and it ended up not getting used, and just kind of kept nagging me to do something with this because she really liked it. So
what TV show or movie was it for?
I can't remember now. It might even have been The Capture, actually, or The One. Might even have been one of those two.
All right, before we go any further, maybe you've been a fan of the show for a while and you own a company and you're saying to yourself, God damn it, I'd love to advertise on the SDR show. Well, it's a very easy way to do it. Head on over to theadside.com, theadside, theadside.com. Click on advertisers and tell them you want to advertise on the SDR show. It's just that easy. ROI for those on the inside track of advertising is extremely high, especially on this podcast, because we have some fucking kick-ass listeners. So go to theadside.com, click on advertisers now, and join us on the SDR show. All right, let's get back into it. The question that's logical is that, obviously, with this solo album, again, called Radio Songs, coming out January 23rd on Cooking Vinyl, you're singing.
Yeah.
You took singing lessons to be ready to do this record. Am I right that you've not done a live show yet as the front man of said band?
No, you couldn't be more wrong.
In fact, I tried.
Count them. Three.
Oh, three shows. Okay.
Magic number, baby.
No, I did the album kind of without taking lessons, but it became clear as I was thinking about how the shows were going to work that really I needed to be able to rely on my instrument. And I've evolved ways over the years of making sure that whatever happens, I can still carry on drumming. You know, most professional musicians have these kind of secret things, like comedians do, that you have something to say if you dry up or if you get heckled. Well, you know, you get all this in reserve. So musicians are the same. So I've evolved that all over the years. And I thought, I'm going to have the same thing with my voice. I'm going to have to be able to rely on it. I'm going to have to be able to have... build it up, have it be strong so that it'll still be as good at the end of the show as it is at the start. So that's when I took singing lessons. Because if I've learned anything, and I've learned very little in my time on this earth, but if I've learned anything, it's that if you want to learn how to do something, there's no better way than paying somebody to explain it to you. You can do the struggling through life, trying to figure it out yourself, but it's long, painful, and it doesn't always work. You just pay somebody.
By the way, that's how I describe sex in the bedroom with me. Long, painful, and doesn't always work.
Well, long is good, but yeah, the other two.
I have a couple other quick questions I want to hit, because we only have an hour with you. So number one, am I right that you have the first music on Mars?
Well, yeah, that was the idea. Alex and I and latterly the band were involved in a Mars explorer called Beagle 2. It's a Mars stationary Mars lab looking for signs of a life on Mars. Mm-hmm. We sent it to Mars. It landed on Mars, but unfortunately, something went wrong and the solar panels didn't fully unfurl, and so the science didn't start. The idea was that it took when it landed, and if it all unfurled properly, the first thing we'd have to do is send a beep back to Earth to say everything's fine. We thought, why not have that beep be a piece of music? So we wrote a little ditty for it to play back, but unfortunately it never got to do it. So the music is still on Mars in this rover or in this lander.
That's pretty cool. That's fucking cool as shit. That's pretty cool. So now the other question is, there was a great song that came out at this point, Jesus, it's almost 20 years ago, I think, called Dig a Hole. You were in a band called the Ailerons. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but there was just one EP and then you never heard about them again. Was that intentional or did the band break up? Like, what was the story behind that?
I know. Well, we've been working on that fairly recently, actually. So watch this space for the Ailerons. Yeah, we, for one reason or another, the project sort of just ground to a halt. And sometimes these things do, for no good reason, really. And we all kind of got focused on other things, meant to pick it up again, never really did. 20 years have gone by. And during lockdown, we had an idea about how to rework it so that we could release it. And when we listened to what we'd done, it all sounded surprisingly fresh and current.
Well, so, Dig a Hole's a great song. Those that don't hear it, also, it was like a big iTunes song at the time. I don't even think it was some part of the, like a promotion with them. It was such a big song, and then you never heard anything again.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy, isn't it? Well, as I say, watch this space because we have an idea for that.
All right, fair enough. And then my last two little things, and we'll get into the first, but how did you get into being a pilot and how did you get into being a computer animator, just to add to the list of fucking things that you do?
Well, they both came around about the same time. It was because I stopped drinking in 1994 after having drunk enough for several lifetimes. I thought that's enough. And I discovered that there's all these extra parts of the day that I had no idea existed, like Sunday mornings. I had no idea there was such a thing as, I thought time just stopped at about midnight on Saturday night and started again about midday on Sunday. And apparently, no, there's all this extra time there. And mornings in general were a bit of a mystery. But I thought, as if drinking's your hobby, then that's pretty much what you do in your spare time. Right. When you stop, I thought, well, I'm going to have to find something to fill all these hours or it's going to drive me mad. So I spent a week doing a trial lesson of something every day for that week.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, seven different disparate things. I think I did a karate lesson one day it was taekwondo. That's right. Taekwondo one day. I did a flying lesson another day. Another thing. And some of them I never did again. I thought that was fun, but I'm not interested. And flying was a thing like the drumming, where it just captivated me straight away. I just fell in love with it, got completely obsessed with it. And, for many years, I basically lived up at the airfield. I became one of these sad aeroplane people that just live up the airfield talking about aeroplanes with other pilots. And I just flew whenever I could. And for a while, I flew the band around.
Oh, wow. Until
one by one, they dropped out, not literally, but one by one, they decided they didn't want to do it anymore.
I flew a plane. I took a lesson once. I did enjoy it. I was amazed. It was just a little two-seater, three-seater plane, really small plane. But I was amazed maybe he was lying to me, but I felt like I definitely landed the plane. Like, I don't know if he was also helping, but flying was amazing how gentle, like the smallest move on a small plane, you really feel it. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, it's lovely. The smaller planes, I learned in one of those, a two-seater. And yeah, just gentle pressure on the controls. You don't even need to do that. Just touch it and apply a little bit of pressure and the airplane responds. It's quite beautiful. And those small planes are what they do aerobatics in, not those ones that we did our trial lessons in, but little aerobatic planes are really light and you see the pilots flying. You don't even seem to be moving and yet the aeroplane's going like this. The pilots just do these tiny little gentle touches on the controls. But yeah, I'm a flying instructor now, so that's another
thing. Wow, let's just add that to the list. That's so fucking crazy. And now this is my one touchy question, because I did save it for the end. Okay, you mentioned that you stopped drinking in 94.
Yeah.
There, when you Google your name, there's the first thing that comes up.
Yeah,
and I'm sure with Nardwar, right? And it's funny, James and Shannon didn't know him. I read that you say you keep a clip on your phone so that it reminds you that you could be a douchebag when you get drunk or high. My question is really just, did you ever break bread with him or no?
I haven't been back to Canada since that, actually.
Oh, but, man.
Not because of that, but the you know, I did apologize to him the next day, and I sent a more full apology on my website some years later, kind of explaining what had gone on. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's some backstory to it. That was the third of three interviews, which got increasingly kind of fractious, you know, over the course of the three. But yeah, I mean, you know, you don't need to keep clips on your phone anymore. That was a kind of 15 years ago thing. But yeah, I have a YouTube bookmark where if I ever get too big for my boots and decide that actually I'm incapable of being an arsehole, I could just watch that clip and discover, no, it's a well within my capabilities to be the most obnoxious arsehole known to man.
That was a wild interview to watch, man. I was like, ooh, boy, that's crazy. But it's good to know that you've grown, and now because of that, in a way you can say because of that interview, you're a pilot, you're a lawyer, you're all these other things because it got you sober. So that's good news, right?
I know this. I stopped drinking. Unfortunately, it took a while. It took another 10 years to stop doing everything else. So that was, you know, in the middle of that one. That was just towards the end of that, really, the Nardwuar episode. Yeah, there's a few things which were like, ooh, dear, yeah, that this isn't going well.
So, by the way, our producer asked me to explain what actually happened. It looked like in that interview, you came in hot to begin with anyway, and you got into, I would hate to say, it seemed like you physically assaulted him at one point, slightly, and he's known to be this kind of like, for those who don't know who he is, he's been doing interviews forever. He digs deep on people. He finds information about them. He gets in their face. He's an awkward interviewer to begin with. But for whatever reason, was that the first time you met him or no?
No, the third time. So we had three interviews.
Oh, so you said three interviews with him. Yeah. I thought it was okay. Yeah. So it was you had a history with him already.
Yeah. I mean, not that that means anything, you know, just because, you know, I should have been able to control my temper that morning. That was the, you know, that was the morning when I didn't, couldn't, chose not to, whatever.
And you seem to have left mid-interview anyway, right? You walked out of the room.
I don't think so. Well, I mean, I guess the interview is presumably over by then.
It is wild because it shows how, like, we all could be young, dumb idiots every now and then. So it's good to know that, you know.
We all screw up, but... that's not the only time in life I've been an absolute arsehole. It's just that the cameras always seem to be rolling at those points.
Right. You know? Yeah, for sure. It is annoying though. It's wild that this, the first, it's the autofill on YouTube when you type in your name, which is crazy so many years later.
It's joined us both at the hip, you know, in a way.
I think what you should do, which would be cool, do an interview now. That would be cool. Yeah.
Well, it'd be great to play in Canada again. I mean, you know, we have barely played in North America since that time. You know, played a couple of shows.
You should have him introduce you guys when you play Canada in a few. That would be fucking great. That would be cool as shit. All right, so name of the show is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We've asked every guest this question since the dawn of time. The first experience with all three.
The first time ever. Song. Concert, did drugs, had sex.
We start with rock and roll, and we just mean the first concert you went to on your own, and hopefully or one that you wanted to go to, and hopefully it's something we know and not some local band we never heard of.
Well, I guess my gig going started in the punk days. In the late 1970s, so and the big venue was our university, Essex University, which is the university in the town I grew up. So I saw all of the punk bands of the day, really, you know, that were touring. So I remember seeing, I saw X-Ray Specs, I saw who even knows?
You see the Damned?
No, I never saw the Damned. They were too big, really. They'd moved out of the kind of small gig circuit.
Got it.
What was the band that did look Gary Gilmore's eyes? Talk amongst yourselves for a moment. I'm just going to Google that. So I think that was the very first of them. Gary Gilmore's eyes.
Oh, you're looking it up.
Yeah. And that
is, hey, Rob,
the adverts. The adverts.
The adverts. The adverts. I think that was the first band, and that they had a female bass player called Gay Advert, who I just fell utterly in love with, just transfixed by her. She was wonderful. So awesome. I think that was the first of my punk rock shows.
And were you already playing music at that time or no?
Yeah, I was a young kid, but I've been in bands since I was kind of 11 years old, really. So I was maybe 13 or something like that.
And now
I was playing in bands with much older boys, but we were struggling to get gigs because they had this kid on drums, you know.
Yeah, I mean, who wants an 11-year-old in the nightclub? I can tell you that right now. So now the first drug you ever did after weed, unless weed wasn't your first drug.
After weed, unless weed wasn't your first drug, I was just sorting out the ramifications of that. So you're not interested in weed.
Yeah, because most people's first drug is weed. That's why.
Yeah. God, you see, I've had 40 minutes to consider this. I don't know. I guess it probably must have been cocaine. Okay. I wasn't very interested in drugs at all. I was interested in drink. I was a drinker, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really until I stopped drinking. I had this brilliant idea that clearly I've got a drink problem, but I don't have a drug problem, to which I should have added yet. So yep. I think I thought, well, cocaine, that's like alcohol. I'm going to try that. And that was the beginning of that. I'll tell you, that didn't end well.
Are you totally sober now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And now the first time little Davey had sex.
I was a late starter with all of that. I was 18.
Oh, 18, that's late.
And at university. And,
the reason why I said little Davey, James, because I think he was 11 years old in a band. I figured some broad picked him up at a bar.
Takes the shine off when you ask someone about their virginity. When you go little, when did little day? Who do we want to talk about popping their cherry when you refer to them like they should be waiting for a Tootsie Roll pop outside of a 7-Eleven, for Christ's sake?
You were 18. Was it a girlfriend? Was it a one timer?
Yeah, it was a one timer. There's a girl. I was at college at that point, and there was a girl I absolutely had a major crush on. But I was terrified of girls of those days, you know. I just didn't know how to approach them, didn't know how to talk to them. You know, it's a...
When Blur got signed, how old were you at that point? Because it was 90, 91, like how old were you?
I was early 20s, I think.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't little more. Wasn't little more, Ralphie.
You had a little hair on his scrotum. He was a little older. He's
fine. All grown up, baby.
All right, so now the new album is called Radio Songs. It comes out January 23rd on Cooking Vinyl. Blur is doing some crazy fucking, maybe a full-fledged tour, but starting off in England there.
We got to go see Blur if they come to New York.
I would love to see Blur. Jesus Christ. I think the most recent single was Tape Measure. I don't know if there's been a fifth single yet off of Radio Songs. And a new Blur album, TBD, at this point. You go to David Roundtree on Instagram or DaveRoundtree.com for all things Roundtree. Am I leaving anything else off that you want to plug before we go around the room, sir?
No, that's all good. No, I think you've covered it all there in a professional, if I may say so, a very professional way. I very much enjoyed this interview. I think if I were to give you a rate this interview with this
Please
kind
do.
Of star system, I'd give it probably a four.
Well, out of how many? Out of how many, though?
Yeah, no, 20. No, five.
Okay, so let's say it's 4.5. I'm going to round up 4.5 because it makes me feel better. What do you think would have made it a five, out of curiosity?
Wait, you can't add the half.
He said four and a half.
All right, fine.
Yeah, I know, but can you round up? I think I'm going to have to round down, really. It's a four. No, uh-huh. It's good.
Four is good, Ralph.
Four and a half is what he said initially.
Yeah, I think the little Davey thing, I think that took the shine off it slightly.
A little ding.
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, you know, talk about attacking somebody's masculinity.
Thank you.
I mean, if that only took me down a half point, I'll take it. All right. James, your plugs.
I mean, it'd be great if James had got a chance to speak. I mean, it was me that didn't let him speak. But
that's fine. So that goes back. If it's you, then it goes back to 4.5. Fuck you. That's fair enough.
It was a pleasure. As an old failed bass player, I just play in the spaces, dog. I just play in the spaces. I let you breathe. I let you shine. And occasionally I get my shots in at Ralph. It's a good day, baby. It's a good day. The James Mattern, THE. I know I say the like an animal. So some people are like, D? No, it's the.
Why not the?
The? I don't know. I mean, I went to public school in Vegas. What do you want from me, baby? I wasn't in London.
There's no miscommunication with people thinking D if you say the James Mattern.
But I'm a fun boy, Ralph.
All right, fine.
The James Mattern, on YouTube and Instagram. I got a website coming out soon, but we're just whatever. It's gonna be there. Check it out. Check out the check spot. You can get the vinyl on pinchrecords.com. It's a dope vinyl. It's me dealing with people drunk, paying their bills. It's the greatest thing ever, and I'll be announcing my new project soon that's just as dope. That's it. I got nothing else to say. I'm just
okay, now we let Shannon speak. Shannon, it is now you are allowed to speak. Go.
Yay. You can follow me on Instagram at ShannonLee6982 and listen to my podcast, The Thing Is Ding. We talk about bad dates, fighting, and ghosts. We have all sorts of interesting guests come on, comedians, musicians, reality TV stars, porn stars, and they tell their own personal stories about their worst date experience, a time they got into a street fight, and an experience with the paranormal.
Okay, now, David, do not give any indication here at all. This is a hard one for me. The question is, do not indicate, does David Roundtree, pilot, computer animator, singer, politician, lawyer, composer, animator, does he believe in ghosts? This is a fucking hard one. I'm hard. Going with no.
Hard.
And I'm curious what James says.
This is easy, baby. This is as easy as Arsenal winning the EPL. That's for you, my friend. I'm an Arsenal guy. Dude, it's a no.
Okay, Shannon.
Earlier.
Shannon?
I have had this in the back of my mind during the whole episode. I'm having a hard time getting a read. I was going to say no, but I'm just going to go against the two of you. And I'm going to say yes.
I like that he's covering his mouth to give no indication.
To me, that's an indication. To me, the way he's doing it is such a blatant. You guys aren't serious. You know how the fuck I feel on this.
All right, let's hear it. Let's hear, David. What's the answer?
I'm gonna be annoyingly I'm going to be annoyingly it and say it depends how you define it, really. I'm pretty sure that all these visions and things that people have mean something. I'm not convinced they're the spirits of dead people. I think there may be a more interesting explanation for it all.
So it's something paranormal.
Yes, that's
yeah, something paranormal. I think that's
something
it.
Unexplainable.
No, I think there's something explainable. Honestly, I do. I think we'll get to
Florence.
Interesting how in France there is no tradition of haunting of houses. And I used to live in France for a few years, and they don't have ghost stories in France. They don't have haunted houses. They don't, you know. So this isn't a universal phenomenon that people see. So is it a physical phenomenon? Is it a psychological phenomenon? That's what I'm musing on. But it clearly is a phenomenon. People do, you know. People I know have seen things, and you know, my girlfriend has a great ghost story. She was in a hotel, and she had to get this woman out of the way, who was in the way, standing between her and the lift, and it was all a bit awkward. And she went down, told reception. She said, she's not a woman with long white hair, is she? I said, yes. She said, oh, she's the ghost. She's, you know, well, my girlfriend's no fool. She actually saw that. And
I'm putting this in the yes column. You know. I'm sorry. Dave's in the yes column.
I'm okay with it. But
is that the spirit of a dead person? I'm less convinced that that's the explanation. But she definitely saw something. So what is the explanation? I think there's probably a more interesting explanation that teaches us more about how the world works than this is the spirits of dead people, which I think is a bit unlikely.
I like it.
I still like it. I'll accept it. My answer is always, there's no way to fucking know. Who the fuck knows? You know, I would say astrology may end up being the one true science at one point. Who knows? You know, but I don't like to speak in absolutes. Yes, James, you're going to shit on me for this?
Oh, I'm very happy. I just, this is the best way to end this podcast. The way you explained it, sir, when everyone's like, is it unexplained? No, I think it's something that can be explained. That is, as a kid, once again, if we can tie it back to the feud, you were the smarter band. And to me, that is an answer that someone from Blur would say, and all due respect, if we interviewed Liam, and he'd probably be like, I am a ghost, and then he'd probably call us all cunts. And that's the difference.
God, I would love that, by the way.
Is that what you want? I mean, do you think
you
should start the interview?
I want you to be who you are, and that was spectacular.
Follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton, my other podcast that comes out every Monday on health and wellness, called the Good Sugar Podcast, all currently in the top 50 of iTunes. We're opening up our first store on 3rd and 69th Street before the end of the month. And you can find, as I said, follow me right. I'm Ralph Sutton. Dave Roundtree, we add a song every week. We'll add the song Tape Measure, the newest single, to our playlist, cscrshow.com/playlist. And thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
The pleasure's all mine. Thanks very much. Nice to meet you.
If it was all yours, it'd be a 5, not a 4. You know, let's be honest.
Yeah, 4.5 out of 5 for the pleasure is mine.
We can get better. We can work on it.
Yeah, next thank you so much. Let's try and make it a 5.
That's it. When you come to New York, it's Blur. We'll do the whole band and we'll get it to 5. We'll totally have
it. Perfect.
All right, thank you.
I'm going to dress as a ghost for that. I'm going to put a sheet over me and go, ooh.
Thank you so much, sir. That was honestly a blast. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
my
man.
My pleasure. Nice to see you all.
Be well, man.
Oh, thank you.
Take care.